With your permission, I shall sit while speaking, as what I shall have to say may well take over an hour. What is planned to be said this morning is the most important thing I have ever said, certainly in this life, and I believe ever in any of the incarnations that have been mine in the past. If you get its bearings, it'll be perhaps the most important thing ever said in the West. I plan to tell you certain things that have been largely esoteric concerning myself, which some of you know, which are necessary to the understanding of why it is possible to say these things. And furthermore, because of certain cyclic reasons, it is barely possible that this be the last time that I'll be with you. I hope this is not so. Since what I'm dealing with bears upon the most important feature of what I regard as the most important scripture or shastra available to us, namely, the voice of the silence. The portion that I refer to is at the very close of the section on the seven portals. Those of you who are familiar with the voice of the silence know that it deals with the ascension of the ladder to ultimate realization, to the culmination that is nirvana, and more than that, the renunciation of nirvana. It's the portion dealing with the latter that I shall read. Calm and unmoved, the pilgrim glideth up the stream that to nirvana leads. He knoweth that the more his feet will bleed, the whiter will himself be washed. He knoweth well that after seven short and fleeting births, nirvana will be his. Such is the dhyana path, the heaven of the yogi, the blessed goal that Strotapratis crave. Not so when he hath crossed and won the Aryahata path. There Klesha is destroyed forever, Tana's roots torn out. But stay, disciple, yet one word. Canst thou destroy divine compassion? Compassion is no attribute. It is the law of laws, eternal harmony, alaya self, a shoreless universal essence, the light of everlasting right and fitness of all things, the law of love eternal. The more thou dost become at one with it, thy being melted in its being, the more thy soul unites with that which is, the more thou wilt become compassion absolute. Such is the Arya path of the Buddhas of perfection. Withal, what mean the sacred scrolls which make thee say, Om, I believe it is not all the arhats that get of the nirvanic path the sweet fruition. Om, I believe that the nirvana dharma is entered not by all the Buddhas. Yea, on the Arya path thou art no more Sthulapati, thou art Bodhisattva. The stream is crossed. 'Tis true thou hast a right to Dharmakaya vesture, but Sambhogakaya is greater than a Nirvani, and greater still is Nirmanakaya, the Buddha of compassion. Now bend thy head and listen well, O Bodhisattva. Compassion speaks and says, Can there be bliss when all that lives must suffer? Shalt thou be saved and hear the whole world cry? Now thou hast heard that which was said. Thou shalt attain the seventh step and cross the gate of final knowledge, but only to wed woe, if thou wouldst be Tathagata. Follow upon thy predecessor's steps. Remain unselfish till the endless end. Thou art enlightened. Choose thy way. Behold the mellow light that floods the eastern sky in signs of praise. Both heaven and earth smile, and from the fourfold manifested powers a chant of love ariseth, both from the flaming fire and flowing water, and from sweet-smelling earth and rushing wind. Hark, from the deep, unfathomable vortex of that golden light in which the victor bathes, all nature's wordless voice in thousand tones arises to proclaim, Joy unto ye, O men of my Alba, that is earth. A pilgrim hath returned back from the other shore, and new Arlan is born. The basis of what I shall say is a group of five realizations reported in Pathways, which occurred between 1922 and 1936. Two minor preliminary ones of the form, I am Atman, I the Self am Atman, I am Nirvana. The one that was reported as substantiality is inversely proportional to ponderability, or reality is inversely proportional to appearance. And concerning this, just within the last few months, I came across these words of the voice of the silence, confirming that realization, where it says, study the emptiness of the seeming fullness and the fullness of the seeming emptiness. I'd read those words many times. This time they stood out. And then on the 7th of August, first of two major realizations. 1936, which followed the pattern of Sri Shankara Acharya. The ascension recognized as arising above space, time, and law, leading to the vestibule of moksha, which is nirvana. But I've been impressed long by the words of Kuan Yin, which run this way: never will I accept or receive private individual salvation. Never will I enter into final bliss alone, but forever and everywhere will I strive for the redemption of all creatures throughout the world. At the vestibule of nirvana, one tastes of that which is true of that state, a delight so powerful, so rich, that it is beyond human comprehension. Combined in some way with an energetic potential that the human body can stand but a little of it. An experience of an invulnerable peace and a beauty that makes all earthly beauty seem empty and dead. These qualities, not the result of something else, of delightful experiences, or peaceful ones, or of beautiful objects, but a self-existent delight, beauty, and peace. And along with this, the knowledge that consciousness cannot be destroyed, that immortality in the root sense is not in the least in question, but is an eternal fact. And a totally new perspective in the world view and the understanding of hidden things. I remember looking upon this and thinking of turning one's back upon it, that it seemed rather appalling. For how long? A lifetime? No. A million years. That's more like. And it is said here in this book that that's the great renunciation without compensation. It looked a bit grim. There was one, a sage, whom we knew as Senior, who said, "Watch for a cycle involving the number 33. I knew that a cycle of time, but how much time? I did not. 33 days, weeks, months, years. Certainly didn't seem like 33 days. But after 33 days, there walked into me something I did not know existed and was not therefore seeking it, that transcended the original realization as greatly as the original realization transcended ordinary experience. I had used the figure from Cantor's Transfinite Numbers to express it, that the first transcended ordinary consciousness as a denumerable infinity transcends finite manifolds. And this second was like an infinity of a higher order that infinitely transcended the first infinite. It, however, was not a state of delight, but a state of thoughts between pain and delight, a balance between all dualities whatsoever that are so essential to our very functioning in this outer domain, which we call samsara. Its keynote was the equilibrium, more worthwhile than nirvanic delight. Strange as that may seem to our human understanding, I said to Senior, this certainly is compensation beyond all expectation. Well, he said, the voice of the silence didn't tell it all. It was pictured as a renunciation without compensation, so that the candidate would be completely sincere. The law of compensation cannot be violated. Not all is written here, and that too has been confirmed by Irma, whom some of you know, and who also says more from this same source will come forth in the last 25 years of this century. Well, the importance of what I'll have to say is testified to by certain signs. I wrote it up in a letter to Irma Hamilton, and the result of that was it was read before a secret doctrine class that's held down in Arizona. And instead of an answer in the form of a letter, she and her associate came up here on a rush trip, returning the next day, though extremely busy, and requiring the permission of the brothers, spelled with a capital B. I'll introduce it by reading a copy of the main part of that letter. And also another thing that surprised me very greatly. I've learned here from one who is present that the local Indians have been aware of what's going on and that they approve. And they know it through a certain second sight which seems to be normal with many of them. They experience it as a phenomenon of sensible light. But to read from the letter. 4 weeks and months, I have been in a state of deep brooding, thinking, and penetrating into available sources with respect to the Trikaya and the three fundamental zones or states known as samsara, nirvana, and paranirvana or paranishpana. I've been going over the source material again and again, looking for keys which may appear as isolated sentences, clauses, phrases, or even words. Slowly I've been attaining some rather exciting successes. As an instance, I came across a line in the Voice of the Silence in the section on the Seven Portals, which runs this way. Study the voidness of the seeming full and the fullness of the seeming void. I've read this many times, but it never stood out before. This is precisely the preliminary realization that I had on the banks of El Dorado Creek in 1936 that led to the formulation, substantiality is inversely proportional to ponderability, or appearance is inversely proportional to reality. Another instance occurs in the case of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, largely to be found in footnotes. I find that nearly everything that can be predicated of the clear light is also true of the high indifference, such as unformed, unmade, unsullied, unsullable, and so forth, and also the positive characteristic of equilibrium. One apparent difference is that the clear light emphasizes the quality of light, while the high indifference has the value of twilight, since it is the synthesis of light and darkness, as well as of all other dualities, including samsara and nirvana. Then the question arises, does high indifference have any relation to para nishkama? I know that this is a terribly presumptuous thought, but it persisted in hanging around. But if we assume it to be valid, certain exciting consequences follow that are highly heretical, both from the standpoint of the Brahman and Buddhistic philosophy. To introduce this, I must first refer to certain other correlations. First, the thought occurs to me that there is a correlation between the Trikaya and the three zones or states known as samsara, nirvana, and paranirvana as follows. Samsara corresponding to nirmanakaya, nirvana to sambhogakaya, and paranirvana or paranishpana to dharmakaya. Notice a little difference now. This is where we're getting a little heretical from the correlations that are made in what I read there. If then any entity could be a trikaya, he would or could participate in all three zones or states at the same time. And this is where we're really getting heretical. But this is contrary to statements in the Mystery of Buddha, which incidentally were written by H.P.B., part of a manuscript that was on her desk at the time of her death, was not part of the third volume of The Secret Doctrine, which does exist and is in manuscript form, but was published by Annie Besant as the third volume, and it is not the third volume, but it is authentic HPB material. The most important section in that manuscript was this section of about 11 chapters on the mystery of Buddha. And that has been material that I've been working on very heavily of late. In one or the other place, it is affirmed to be a matter of either or, not both and. Either your dharmakaya or nirmanakaya. It can't be both. But what I'm projecting here, that it is possible to be a trikaya. No doubt it can't be two. It's either or if you are not trikaya. To enter nirvana is to be shut away from samsara. This is what you'll find said over and over again, with some rare exceptions, such as the Blessed One himself. I assume you all know who the Blessed One is. That is the great Buddha. There is only one sevenfold Buddha connected with our humanity today. That's the one whose last normal incarnation was as Gautama, some 600 years B.C., but who has repeatedly appeared since, is, to my own definite knowledge, still accessible. And note here, there is no exception to a law. There are exceptions to rules. If the Blessed One can be in nirvana and also here, that proves that such is in principle possible. No individual can do anything, no matter how rare it is, without thereby proving that that something he does is, in principle, possible. Get the logic of it? Hence, to continue in the activity of redemption, he who has reached to the threshold of nirvana must renounce it and take the Nirmanakaya road. This is the common view. A renunciation said to be for an interminable period of time and without compensation. Think of a million years of organized consciousness without any nirvanic break into pure consciousness. Could any entity endure that without exhaustion? It is not merely a question of willingness to perform, but also of the capacity to do so. See, here is beginning to unfold additional meaning to the mind. But it is not only bliss and withdrawal, but is also the source of refreshment, rebuilding, the strength, the functioning. That's a side that hasn't been emphasized. Now, if the suggested correspondence given above is correct, it would appear that the renunciation of nirvana is equivalent to the renunciation of the Sambhogakaya road. Here's another deviation. Rather than the Dharmakaya road, the latter being associated with Paranirvana. Second, there are other correspondences that I have made, partly in the aphorisms on consciousness without an object, and these are samsara with suffering. And by samsara, we mean the whole universe. I might stop and elaborate what it means. The last figure that I've seen from scientific sources, and they do change pretty rapidly, is that the cosmos has a radius of 10 billion light years. 2 years ago it was 3 billion. They keep changing. But anyway, the whole of the cosmos, planets, stars, galaxies, galactic systems, the whole work is samsara. Not only that, zones or locus, invisible or inaccessible to outer consciousness, all the hell worlds, all the heaven worlds of the ordinary religions are in samsara. Incidentally, most of the heaven worlds are only vital heavens. Those are very inferior. Just think of a heavenly state of sitting on a cloud playing a jew's harp for 10,000 years, infinitely, in fact. Or walking in golden slippers down the golden streets of the New Jerusalem. clackety clack for the rest of eternity. At 3:30 in the afternoon, the Supreme will appear with his only begotten Son beside him, and you will sing his praises every afternoon at 3:30. Or, happy hunting ground of the Indian, purely a Bible heaven, a physical Bible. Or the Norseman's state, where you got up every morning and after breakfast had a grand war with your fellow warriors, and in the evening everybody got healed from his wounds and had a grand feast, and the next morning you repeat it over. Such heavens. They're all in samsara. Not only the vital heavens, but the rarer mental heavens, which are of still much higher order, and only a few ever go there. They're all samsara. That whole thing is what we mean by samsara. Nirvana stands in contrast to it. Conceived as dynamically equivalent, the other of samsara. Get some idea of the level of perceptions we're dealing with. We're putting that whole thing I've described as just one term, and the least valuable term of the whole thing. All that science is concerned with, all that most religion, only religion at its highest point, reaches beyond samsaric realm. Now then, nirvana with bliss, and I indifference, or as suggested, para nirvana, with a state that is neither bliss nor suffering, but a fusion of the two in a state that is more attractive than either, something that is quite inconceivable to a human kind of consciousness. From the foregoing, what I am suggesting is that it is in principle possible for an entity to abide in all three zones or states at the same time. And in this case, there is no renunciation nor sacrifice, save in the sense of rendering sacred, which is the true meaning, etymological meaning of the word, in the labor of redemption. And there would be no problem of exhaustion in maintaining organized consciousness for an indefinite period of time. One would blend in himself the mundane and the supermundane, consciousness as the microcosm. And why should not this be possible? Since manifestly, the macrocosm does so include and blend. And it is said that the microcosm duplicates the macrocosm. No doubt such a microcosmic blending would be rare as yet, but I'm speaking of what is in principle possible. I see in the foregoing the possibility of a new dispensation in which the purification by suffering is replaced by the purification through joy in the transcendental sense. Third, there is still a third set of correspondences which I made several years ago. And this is A, the correlation of samsara with the object of consciousness. B, nirvana with the subject to consciousness, that is the self. And C, the high indifference, or para nirvana, with the consciousness uniting subject and object. This tended to confirm the earlier realization in the form, I am nirvana. The high indifference was a progressive state involving four steps. A, a state of universal satisfaction. B, a state of indifference. And here, many people have stumbled at this word indifference. I mean it in the sense or have been to use as the word equality. Equality of attitude towards all things. You can get it. It's not in the usual sense of the word indifference. This is something that J. William Lloyd, who was the first man to read my manuscript and was himself a mystic, couldn't get. And I imagine you who have read Pathways have probably not gotten. In fact, everything I'll say today is implicit in Pathways, and if you haven't had it already, it shows what you haven't gotten out of Pathways. C, a state in which the subject and object vanished, and only consciousness remained. And D, a movement into darkness, meaning shirik. That's a Tibetan word, and I'll explain it later. Could not make correlation, from which I awoke in the morning with a sense of a still bastard beyond. At the level of C, the subject was the self. The universal object was solely divinity. That is, the inside view of the whole universe is a sense that it is all divinity. With these two aspects being one and the same, as in the realization, Atman is Brahman. The effect of these two vanishing into pure consciousness was to place me in agreement with the Buddhist doctrine of Anatman and Nastikata, or non-theism. Those of you who are familiar with Buddhism know that it teaches the doctrine that the self is not permanent, nor is the divinity permanent. And this realization confirmed that position. I was transformed from an Advaiti Vedantin to a Buddhist. I saw a relative validity in the Vedantin Atmavidya, but a more ultimate validity in the Buddhistic position. A radical implication of all this is, pure consciousness is before any entity becomes. Now that turns it upside down with respect to our ordinary thinking. Entities are functions of consciousness. That is, beings, human beings, gods, angels, whatever you please, devas, whatever you please to call them. They are functions of consciousness, derivative from consciousness, but not the source of consciousness. Entities are functions of consciousness rather than the other way around, as we ordinarily suppose, to use a mathematical type of formulation. This I understand to be the real meaning of the Alaya Visnana of the Buddhists. But there is verification to be found in the writings of H.P.B. In section 41 of the Doctrine of the Avatars, under the mystery of Buddha, the question of the sense in which Lord Buddha was an avatar is discussed. The sense in which this is asserted by the Brahmins, namely, as the descent of the entity Vishnu, is denied, but as Maha Vishnu, or Adi Buddha, or primeval wisdom, or nirvana in short, in quotes, for those are the words of H.P.B., the Lord Buddha was an incarnation of Mahavishnu, and hence an avatar. Elsewhere it is pointed out that he was also a Jivanmukta. But primeval wisdom is a quality of consciousness, and nirvana is a state of consciousness, and this made an avataral descent. You get the point, that here's the use of the conception of avataral descent as meaning not an entity descending, but a quality or state of consciousness descending. It's an extension of the word, and is quite different from Aurobindo's use of the term and of our common understanding of the term. In other words, the avatar can be a quality or state of consciousness rather than an entity. And this leads to questions re the high indifference. Was the high indifference an avatar descent? I was not striving to realize the state, since I did not know that it existed. The earlier realization I had been striving towards, since it had been so clearly formulated by Chakra. But I thought that was... 33 days later, the high indifference walked in on me, or descended upon me, out of the blue, as it were. I have not been able to exclude the possibility that it was Avatar. Then another question arises. Could it have been an initiation of one aspiring to the path of the Jivanmukta? Now bear in mind what Jivanmukta is, as distinct from Avatar. An Avatar is what he is. There's no merit involved. That's his nature. It's a high spiritual consciousness, not something that is a result of attainment. All of us was that, couldn't help himself but be that. A Jivanmukta is one who is striving, as through the human form and so forth, to attain the state that is normal to the being that would be an Avatar. See, in other words, the Jivanmukta attains by effort and merit. And I think would generally be rated as therefore higher even than an Avatar. Then another question arises. Could it have been an initiation of one aspiring to the path of the Jivanmukta? In this case, the presence of the guru initiator was not evident. You see, one does not enter nirvana, and the same would be true of para nirvana, by his own efforts alone. There's some modification of that. This I have to go into as a sort of a parenthetical remark here. The Patika Buddhas do enter nirvana by their own effort. But one arrives at a point by his own merit, his overcoming of all of the temptations of samsaric life, an ascension in knowledge and spiritualization as far as he could by his own merit, by his own virtue. But virtue will not unlock the door of nirvana. But what it does do, and this is a paraphrase of the words of HPB, lead to the guru who already is possessed of nirvanic consciousness, who can initiate him into it. That in general is the way of him who's going the path of masters of compassion. But the Patika Buddhas have attained spirituality selfishly. They do enter nirvana, but without. Now the key to nirvana, you have a right to try for it. It's a state of an almost inconceivable equilibrium between all pairs of opposites that you find in the samsaric world, including good and evil. The key is equilibrium, not goodness. Now, in the Tibetan, you'll find a figure used illustrating the kind of equilibrium it is. Imagine a string. And you balance a pencil on that string. And you get that pencil to roll down and stop and not drop off the string. If you can do that, you maybe get some practice for entering nirvana. Imagine maintaining that kind of equilibrium throughout all of the pairs of opposites within your consciousness. That's the key to nirvanic consciousness, not goodness. Goodness only gets you to heaven. It doesn't get you out of samsara. Now, this is some of the shocking things that are involved in all of this discourse today. think that goodness is not the key to everything that's fine is a bit shocking. Equilibrium is the key to the transcendent. A very virtuous man, a saint-like man, may earn a million years in a heaven world, such as David comes. But he'll come right back to birth again and be in that circling process in samsara, still bound, just as truly as the sinner who differs from him only in that he circles through some hell world and back again here. And that leads to a further conclusion that the saint, as well as the sinner, is in need of redemption. Redemption is from a locked-in samsaric state, not a movement from hellish experiences to heavenly experiences. For the heaven conception is no more than a samsaric conception. Get that point clear. And most of religion that is concerned with this is only the kindergarten stage of religion. And that's most of the religion of the world. I'll say a little more about the problem of redemption later. Another question arose. Could it have been an initiation of one aspiring to the path of the Jivanmukta? In this case, the presence of the guru initiator was not evident. This possibility, however, also I cannot exclude, especially as I lean to the way of self-induced effort and self-devised means. Finally, could there be something of both? No, I do not know how one leaves the state of the high endeavors. There was no compulsion in it. I felt perfectly free to leave it if I so chose, but this was the last thing I wanted to do. The will seems to be all-powerful. What is will eventuate. Terrific sense of power up there. But there was no desire, no reason to will. I knew this was the eternal home, though forgotten. Not only of myself, but of all creatures, down to the last electron. And there was no reality in the supposed suffering of creatures. All of the suffering just seemed to be a bad dream lasting one eye wink in length. Hence, since no creature was doomed, there seemed to be no need of the office of compassion. Hence the motivation of compassion had no force since there was no need anywhere. It was quite possible to leave the state, but there was no basis for motivation to do so. And ever since, I do not feel that I've ever really left it, and have always abode in it, though not knowing it, while now I do. It seems now to lie in the background of relative consciousness, whereas it had been for a few hours in the foreground. For the past 33 years, it has seemed as though I dwelt in a zone which in the beginning was ninth edge, but has become broader and easier since, lying between two worlds of consciousness, connected by the relationship of inversion. Now, this principle of inversion is very fundamental. I found it over and over again, then I find in reading Aurobindo, he gives it a very important place. You don't go in a straight line, but there's an inversion like this, and that happens. If you move through two different states, you get another inversion. It's not in the same direction. If one direction is here, beyond is not that way, but an inversion is. For the past 33 years, it has seemed as though I dwelt in a zone which in the beginning was knife edge, but this has become broader and easier since, lying between two worlds of consciousness connected by the relationship of inversion. In one, the self, or I, seemed like a point contained by an environment, while in the other, the self was a sphere embracing the whole universe. You get the version there? In the transition between these two, there was a momentary blackout. And try as much as I could not render that momentary blackout conscious. But is this place of the momentary blackout the place where indeed I dwell? Is it perchance the zone of the high indifference, or nirvana? The three zones ranging themselves in the form of a triangle, samsara nirvana forming the base, and para nirvana the apex. This is quite different from the image I had before 1936, in which the three zones lay in a vertical line. Mayhap he who dwells in the state of nirvana. Now look at this. This is very heretical. Mayhap he who dwells in the state of nirvana, who is not also a para nirvani, is locked in a way analogous to the familiar locked-in condition of the dwellers in samsara. Now you'll find statements like this, that he who enters nirvana stays in for maha kalpa. He who enters para nirvana stays in for manvantara. Period that's given as 4,320,000,000 years. I'm saying here that he who's a para nirvani can become liberated from the locked-in state either in samsara or nirvana, but can be a free mover between them. That was contained in the realization itself, that sort of information, way back, and was reported in Pathways. And it gives you a very different picture altogether. Then only the paranirvani could move at will between the two states or be conscious at the same time in both. Is this heresy? I know that I'm on dangerous ground, but so my thought has grown. For this certainly contradicts statements in the Voice of the Silence and the Mystery of Buddha. A few months ago it dawned upon me that the year beginning, either on the 7th of August 1968 or September 9, 1968 was the 33rd since the same date since 36. That means 33 years now. After the event of 1936, I was warned to watch out for a cycle involving the number 33. After 33 days, the high indifference walked in. But may the cycle of 33 years have significance. On the hypothesis, a better way to write of it, I think, this is kind of esoteric, it's part of our technique of communicating to those who have ears to hear while others who hear don't know what's been said. On the hypothesis that a forma pseudopodal projection of the entity of which this person is now a pseudopodal projection was the junior parter in a toku combination of which the blessed one was the senior partner. Certain consequences follow. That junior partner, it is said, committed suicide by act of will at the time of the dissolution of the combination, thereby invoking the karma of violent death against his will at the same age, which was 33 years. The hypothesis asserts that this did occur in a subsequent pseudopodal projection when there was another tulku combination with the same senior partner, also at the age of 33 years. There seems to be a law that two events of the same kind call for a third to complete the series. The thought comes that the 33 years since the August and September dates possibly have important significance and probably have something to do with the transition. If not actual death, then perhaps an initiatory equivalent. In any case, important thoughts are coming into my mind in this 33rd year. Now, I've told you a lot of esoteric things in that, if you can understand what I said. The pseudopodal theory of the interpretation of reincarnation is something I taught myself, and it seems to be pretty pat. It seems quite compatible with what Buddha said on the subject. I wonder how many of you know about amoebas and the way they travel, how they stick out a projection from their bodies, which are like legs or arms, and pull back, and another one will come out. It's not the same one again. They call those pseudopods. Well, now, use that to indicate what we mean by incarnation. That the real entity that we are is the entity behind that never is seen here. It actually is the monad, or the karana, upadi. And the pseudopodal projections are from that karana, upadi. It was not correct to say that this person is a reincarnation of another person historically. But it is correct to say, can be correct to say, that this is a pseudopodal projection from an entity that sent forth another pseudopodal projection, a ray at another time, and so on down the way. It's the way you all work. That's a valid way of viewing reincarnation. Really meant. And the reason why so much understanding of it is mistaken. This personality does not reincarnate again. But there is a karmic relationship between one pseudopodal projection and another. And Toku. How many of you are not familiar with the concept of Toku? Those who are not. It was not much referred to in the last quarter of the last century, although there are references. But it wasn't played up. In the case of the great Buddha, the last normal incarnation, in which he actually owned the body, the physical body, which he occupied. He grew from babyhood on up. That last time was as Gautama. Since then he's appeared many times, but always in tuku combinations. In a tuku combination, another entity, presumptively a chela of the greater entity, provides the vehicle. Then certain principles are replaced. According to the statement in the Mystery of Buddha, HPB, it was the intermediate principles. The intermediate principles consisting of lower and higher mind and karma. Incidentally, karma in its purity is a high function. It's the basic compassion. We know it only in its lower degenerate states. And that in the case of Shankara, for instance, this Brahman, baby, belonged to another entity than that of Buddha, that the intermediate principles were the intermediate principles of Buddha, the purest at the time, and that there was thus that combination that made that very brilliant life. But the responsibility for it, the great power in it, is the great Buddha. Now, I call the great Buddha in that case the senior partner, and the one that provided the body as a junior partner. Now, there was a withdrawal of the Buddha's principles at the age of 32, and the replacement by the corresponding principles that belong to this entity. That had meanwhile been kept in what you might call cold storage. There's a question there, how they are preserved and so forth. I've only heard one little item bearing upon how they can be carried or maintained for a time. But we may call as cold storage as a figure of speech. Naturally, they were not developed because they were in storage during that incarnation. The effect of their replacement could mean a very heavy depression from brilliance to at least seeming stupidity and an inability to deal with the problems of your chelas, her disciples. So, it is said Shankara went into a cave and was never heard of since. The esoteric statement is he entered the cave and commit suicide by act of will. He couldn't take it, or thought he couldn't. Invoking karma, therefore, that required death against his will by violence at the same age in a later life. The implication is that inasmuch as we know the compassion of the great Buddha, who said, when the Brahmins persecuted his disciples, they have sinned, but I am the cause of their sin, and therefore I shall come to them. Man suffering wrong had his compassion, but also man doing wrong had his compassion. And so he came as Shankara. And you can see, although this is not said, how in the case of Shankara, who commits suicide, you would say he is sinned, but I am the cause also of his sin. So I shall come to him again. There may well be that is the reason why there was the incarnation of the Christ. It may not have been that it would have taken place otherwise. The statement with respect to the Triple Crown, now this is something I might possibly read to you, has a premier causal place in the line of thought that is here developed. Early in the first volume of The Secret Doctrine, there is a statement which runs as follows. He who enters Parinirvana without Paramatha Satya is in a state of extinction for 7 eternities. This I read as being in a state of absolute unconsciousness. Paramatha Satya is defined as the self-analyzing consciousness, and so has a certain similarity to interoception, which was defined spontaneously. Interoception is my own word. It's introduced into the philosophy of consciousness without an object. As the power whereby the light of consciousness turned upon itself towards its source. Questioning the meaning of this, it dawned upon me that the light of consciousness was the cognitive aspect of consciousness, in contrast to which the pure consciousness is the substance of which all things are composed and could therefore be called substantive consciousness. Correlate this then with something I found recently in the footnotes on pages 96 and 97 of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. It says there, Rigpa, meaning consciousness, as distinct from the knowing faculty by which it cognizes or knows itself to be. The cognizing faculty is called Shirig. Shesrig. Ordinarily, Shirig is the power that cognizes phenomena, but when turned upon itself, I can see that it becomes what is meant by the definition of interception. I have long been aware of this consciousness of consciousness. In footnote number 3, page 96 above, we find the following. Quoting, from the union of the two states of mind or consciousness implied by the two terms, Rigpa and Shirig, and symbolized by the all-good father and the all-good mother, is born the state of the Dharmakaya, the state of perfect enlightenment, Buddha. This I found simply dumbfounding. From all the foregoing, it would appear that the absolute unconsciousness, which is not in reality, becomes realized as absolute consciousness when the light of consciousness turns upon itself towards its source, or when Paranishpana is combined with Paramatha Satya, or when Shirig is united with Rigpa. For the first time in this 33 years, I have found a number of confirmations. But why, it may be asked, is confirmation necessary? For the assurance of realization is unequivocal. with respect to the ground covered by it? The answer seems to be that the assurance is valid so long as there is no interpretation or transcription, even to one's own mental consciousness. But when there is transcription, so that one may understand or communicate, error can enter. The secret doctrine states that confirmation is fundamental to occult science. These confirmations give me an increased assurance. But further criticism is not only welcome, but is solicited from whatever source is competent to do so. As I see it, all this is not only important to me, but has a general importance, since if the above thought is valid, then a line has been established in the Western psyche or collective unconscious that leads to enlightenment. That was the letter. Two very busy people came up for a one-day stop only because of that. And this has developed into other implications. I'll have to rush this because this is taking up time. One is, I've partially spoken of, that it changes the whole meaning of redemption. The Christian thinks of redemption as redemption from sin. That the saint certainly doesn't need redemption, he's redeemed. That to get to the heaven world is all that's required. But what is implied here is that redemption is more than that. It implies the capacity to leave samsaric zone, including the heaven worlds and the hell world and all of this cosmos that we know, that the scientists deal with. The capacity to leave it. And as therefore the saint, particularly he who is attached to his saintliness, is in need of redemption as truly as a sinner. Secondly, how about the Pratika Buddhas, those who are locked in nirvana? This conception of locked nirvana and the intimation I had in the high indifference of a state that could be entered and left is confirmed in Tibetan material that has come through us through the editorship of Evans Wentz, of which there are four bodies. It confirms in the Tibetan yoga and secret doctrine the conception of a difference between a fixed nirvanic state and a non-fixed. The Pratika Buddha is locked into nirvana through his spiritual selfishness as truly as ordinary men are locked into samsara. And he presents, therefore, a problem for redemption. The fully redeemed state is a state of complete liberation, then, if you follow this conception, in which one is a free mover between the nirvanic and the samsaric state, and that therefore there need not be, when one at least has reached a certain point, any more of the renunciation, the foregoing of nirvanic consciousness while functioning as a redeemer. However, what it be implied is that one must attain not simply the power to enter nirvana, but the power to enter power in nirvana before this becomes possible. I know there are very few of the whole of humanity who have entered nirvana or have had the power to do so, and still fewer who've known power nirvana. And now come some things that even those who have been here and heard me speak before have not yet heard. Whenever we talk of anything whatsoever, we either implicitly assume or explicitly designate a basic reference. And whatever is said is to be judged as true or false with respect to that base of reference. And with respect to any other base of reference is simply irrelevant. An illustration is this. The ship from the base of reference in astronomy where your coordinates are taken as fixed with respect to the Earth. That gives you the Ptolemaic system. And the movement of the sun and all the planets is in the form of certain cycloids, epicycloids, or epi-epicycloids around the Earth. The statement is valid from that base of reference. To make the Copernican change and establish your base of reference or coordinates as fixed with respect to the ecliptic, which is the path of the Earth, and would thus be fixed with respect to the sun. And the path of the Earth and of all of the planets, to a first approximation, is an ellipse around the sun. A vast simplification. That is true from that point of view. To say that the path of the planets and the Earth is an ellipse around the sun is not true from the Ptolemaic point of view. It's simply irrelevant. And you get the point. Something is to be judged with respect to its base of reference. Now the secret doctrine is a state presented to man of the structure of the evolving cosmos with very minor references to the Nirvanic side. Oriented to the base of reference called samsara. The only possible form in which it could be communicated to humanity. And therefore, with respect to that base of reference, time and space are pertinent. There are vast distances in space. There is a past and a future in time. And we look at these enormous periods before you can lay your head down in rest. 4,320,000,000 years. Or 311,040,000,000 years. Perfectly valid statements, no doubt, from the standpoint of a base of reference. Taken in samsara. But suppose we take our base of reference in nirvana. Nirvana is timeless and spaceless. That's implied in the very statement that it's not a location but a state. From a base of reference that is timeless and spaceless, there's no such thing as distance in space. That which is far here is not far there. That which is past here is not past there, and that which is yet to come in the future. Is present now. I had that experience in my indifference. Where is the beginning and the end and the all between? At once. Here. Now. So, one can see, he who has the power to enter and to leave the nirvanic realm can enter the samsaric, since time is your own, at any point in the past or any point in the future, as well as at this point. And that provides time travel. Without mechanism. And also, since distance in space is meaningless, he can enter, in principle, the far and the near equally well, because far and near have no meaning there. And this without any mechanism. but just by a movement in consciousness, requiring no doubt technical equipment in consciousness. But you can see how it is in principle possible. And thus renders this moon travel to a position that's rather insignificant for the Nirvani, who is not locked in, can pierce anywhere and gain knowledge directly, without ships, without a lot of physical technology. And these are some of the rather startling conclusions that are all implicit in what you've read in Pathways Through the Space, if you've understood what you have read. There's more that I could say, but time has passed and my voice is vanishing. So I think we'll go to the concluding portion of our meeting at this moment.